Well, hello, good morning. It's 11:05. It's Sunday morning. It's Abbey 104. And it's time for Folk Tales. And in the studio this morning, I have Debbie Hicks. Good morning, Debbie.
Morning, Terry.
And Debbie, you are the leading light behind Stoke Hill. Stoke Hill Farm, it's Stoke Hill Education and Training, it's called, really, isn't it? It's the official name.
Well, Stoke Hill's an organisation that I set up on the farm several years ago, initially to provide free educational visits for school groups that are properly linked to the curriculum so that children can really learn about where their food comes from and about different types of farming, but also so that it's embedded into the curriculum. It's difficult for schools to find the time to take a group out. So if you can cover something useful that they would otherwise have to cover at school, whether it's science or English, and really whatever key stage it is, from 5-year-old all the way up to 16-year-olds, it's good to be able to do that. And I also offer training for teachers around how they can improve the connection between children and food farming in the countryside.
Okay, and this is something you've been doing a little while now, isn't it?
It is. I'm, as well as Stoke Hill, I'm the South West Consultant for Farming and Countryside Education. That's FACE.
FACE, yes.
Yes, and it's a part-time role, but I cover Dorset, Wiltshire, Somerset, South Gloucestershire, Devon and Cornwall. And it's a very diverse role. And sometimes I work directly with schools, and occasionally that's on the farm, but all across the region, and with all sorts of other organisations. So it might be an agricultural society, so I'm involved in the Bath and West Education Day, and that has around 1,000 pupils looking at all aspects of farming. Or it might be the Melplash Show Society. I did something for teachers there. Or it might be an initial teacher training provider, all sorts of organisations.
OK, we're going to explore all of that a bit more. And you're a teacher, actually, by trade, as it were.
I am, a biology teacher.
Yes, OK. We'll talk some more about that in due course and how you came to be involved in all of those things. But before we do, let's have a record, shall we? And your first one is Peter Shelley and Love Me, Love My Dog. Why this one?
Well, as anyone who knows me would be aware, dogs have been a motif running all the way through my life, from the family dogs. My earliest memories include dogs. And as soon as I could, I had a dog as an adult. I have three dogs that share my life with me and my husband, Mark. They're very important to me. I'm not the sort of doggy person who buys magazines or goes to craft show or dresses the dogs up in clothes, but I adore my dogs and I adore the dogs of my closest friends as well.
Wonderful, and no better reason than to have this one. It's Peter Shelley, Love Me, Love My Dog.
Dusty road heading to a highway, Californian skyways lead us where we want to stay. Suddenly a summer breeze breaks a misty morning, there's a new day dawning, we better be on our way. So love me, love my dog, we've lived the road too long to break up. Love me, live my life, and travel through this land. I can't leave a friend, I promised that before we started. So love me, love my dog, if you can understand. Then we'll head upland. When I leave this town today, Lord, you know I'll miss you. Baby, I won't kiss you, you'd only make me wanna stay. Though it's hard to say goodbye, can't you see it's over? Guess I'm just a loner, heading on his way. you now, love me, love my dog. We've left the road too long to break up. Love me, live my life and travel through this land. I won't leave a friend. I promised that before we started. So love me, love my dog. If you can't understand, then we'll head up land. Just love me and love my dog. If you can't understand, then I guess we'll have to move on out our plan.
That's Peter Shelley and Love Me, Love My Dog from 1975. Got to number three in the UK. And that was chosen by my guest in the studio today, who is Debbie Hicks. And Debbie, you were saying dogs are a big theme in your life. You're a dog lover.
I am a dog lover, but really only specific dogs, not a general rushing up to people's dogs and shoving my face in their muzzles sort of person.
That's good. Anyway, let's go back, shall we, and talk about your early life. And are you a native to this part of the world?
No, I'm not. I grew up in Surrey. It wasn't rural, but where our house was, there was common land opposite and then woods and golf courses round it. So there was always quite a sort of country feel. And I used to be outside a lot of the time with my sister, Joey. I shouldn't really call her Joey. She hasn't been called Joey by anybody for decades. She's a consultant surgeon and elite athlete, but to me, she's still my little sister, Joey, who I did all my growing up with.
And just the one sister?
Just the one sister. So yeah. It was the four of us, my parents, my sister and I, rattling around in quite a big house this area.
Very nice. And mother and father, what were their occupations?
My mother's occupation was looking after us full-time. Okay, yeah. My father had been in the army and he was a regular forces employment officer. So he worked mainly quite near us in Croydon, but he used to have to go off to barracks every so often, which I always found very scary because it was around the time of the trouble. So I was always very pleased to see him come home. I would stand and look out of the window and count the cars waiting for him to come back.
Sure. Oh, very good. And so you went to school in Surrey?
Yes, I went to Croydon High. Joey and I both went there. And that was a wonderful school, quite an academic school. I wasn't necessarily the most focused pupil. I did get into trouble in a very low grade, irritating way quite a lot. But I had a whale of a time. And I think it was a brilliant school to have gone to. People sometimes say you can tell a Croydon High School girl as soon as she opens her mouth. And I think generally, it's a good thing. A bit argumentative, I think we might be.
The happy days at school?
Yes, enjoyed it? Not necessarily for all the right reasons, but very happy, thank you.
And academically, you were okay, you're saying?
I think, as a teacher now, I would be saying Debbie does not always fulfil her potential, and it's time she settled down a bit, which indeed was what was written about me. My sister was very academic. And still is.
I guess lots of people that go on to do great things have had that written about them in early life, haven't they?
Yes.
So any early interests around about then? You obviously became a teacher, which we'll come on to in a minute. But did that start to form during school days or did you have other ambitions?
Well, my overriding interest was ponies throughout my schooling. And unfortunately, the classroom in the junior school looked across to the local riding school, which I think had a slightly detrimental effect on my learning. But I loved biology all the way through. I loved biology. I had brilliant biology teachers. And I, apart from a slight dalliance with thinking I might do nursing or physiotherapy, teaching was always in the frame, but I was passionate about biology, so I didn't want to go straight on to do a teaching qualification. I wanted to do a degree in pure biology in case I decided to go on and do research.
I see. So it was likely you were going to do university anyway, and
yes.
That's indeed what eventually happened.
Yes.
So you had to do A-levels, presumably.
Oh, yes, I did biology, chemistry and English.
I see. Yeah, so mainly scientific.
Yes.
And so what about the choice of universities? How did that pan out?
Well, in fact, I chose the university that my A-level biology and my lower down the school biology teacher went to. It was a sort of last minute, oh my goodness, I am going to go to university decision. And so I thought, well, they're pretty good. So that's where I'm going to go. And that was Queen Elizabeth College in London. It was part of King's College, London University. Then it separated off to be Queen Elizabeth. And then just as I was leaving, it got subsumed back into King's again.
I see. And it was always going to be biology, was it?
It always was going to be
that
biology.
That was your
yes.
favourite
very much
of the
so.
Subjects, yeah. So off you went to university. So this was in London. Did you move up to London?
Queen Elizabeth College was in Kensington, the sort of place that one would not normally have a chance to live. And absolutely beautiful, backing onto Holland Park and just off Kensington High Street. So it was a wonderful place to be. But as a typical student, I spent most of my time either in the halls, in the lecture theatres or labs, or in the union bar.
Nothing unusual there. But was it much of a culture shock? I mean, you'd grown up in fairly rural Surrey, by the sound of it, and off you went to London to live. Was that much of an up-wrench?
Not at all, actually. I settled in from day one and had a uniformly brilliant time, I think. I think because of the preparation that Croydon High had given me academically, actually, the first year was quite easy. We seemed to have covered a certain amount of the work, and it was incredibly interesting, and I was surrounded by people who were great fun and quite different to some of the people I'd been to school with.
People often make lifelong friendships at university. Have you found that to be the case?
I have kept some of the friends I made at university, yes, one particularly so. But I would say that I've got my closest friends you could pick from different decades of my life. And probably there's four or five people who are central to my life now, rather than lots and lots of people that I see occasionally.
Yeah, I see. So you were taking biology then, you're reading biology in London. How did it go? The time comes, obviously, when you have to decide what you're going to do, but was it an enjoyable course?
It was an excellent course. And towards the end of it, I thought maybe research is the way ahead. So I had a think about staying on and doing a PhD, but the teaching idea was pretty firmly embedded, so I decided to go to King's College London to do a PGCE, a postgraduate certificate in education, so that then I was the fully finished teacher. Well, nearly fully finished.
All right, well, that's probably an appropriate moment to have your second track. Now, this one's something a bit different. I must admit I'd never heard of this group, but tell us about it. It's called Pig Bag, isn't it?
This is Pig Bag, and it's a quintessentially Queen Elizabeth College disco track. It's not the best piece of music ever, but it reminds me of a time that was great fun, and you could pretty much rely on it being played of a Wednesday night and everyone getting up and having a dance.
OK, well, the group's called Pig Bag, and the title is Papa's Got a Brand New Pig Bag. And let's just play it, see what you make of it.
We'll be right back.
Well, there you have it. That's Pig Bag by Papa. No, the other way around. Papa's got a brand new Pig Bag by Pig Bag the group, and chosen by Debbie Hicks, my guest in the studio. And Debbie, that's something you were rocking around the student union bar to.
And around your studio too.
Yes, it's catchy. I think I might have heard it before. From 1981, that, and they were a British post-punk band, apparently. And it's a parody on James Brown's Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, which I can't say I actually know that one either. But anyway, as I say, Debbie Hicks is my guest in the studio, and Debbie is now the leading light behind Stoke Hill, which is an educational facility up in not far from Wincanton, aren't you?
No, between Bruton and Wincanton.
Yes, but we've been talking about Debbie's early life and her schooling in Surrey and then university in London. And Debbie, you came to a point where you had to leave university and you had thoughts of doing research, but why did you decide not to in the end?
Because I had gone to get the degree originally to become a teacher, because that's really what I wanted to do. So it was time to leave and get that job.
As you have to eventually, don't you? And you did a degree in biology, but then you were saying you did a PGCE, which is the teaching qualification.
That's right.
And so obviously at that point you were committed, you were going to be a teacher. You left university, you had to find a job. How easy was that?
It was very easy at that time. And I ended up going to teach in a secondary modern in the Medway towns at Raynham School for Girls. It was a very large, and still is a very large, secondary modern. And it was enormous fun. It couldn't really have been much more different to the school I went to. And a problem at the time was low aspirations of the girls there. But it was a very rewarding school to teach in. And I stayed there for 4 years. And I loved it. I took on a role as assistant exams officer, as well as teaching biology all the way through the school and all the sciences to 16. And it helped me to develop my skills and confirmed that I wanted to be a teacher, and really was a springboard to everything I've done since.
I often wonder, coming from a university background, and then suddenly you find yourself in front of a class of 30 pupils, and you say some of them got low aspirations, some of them didn't particularly want to be there. Is that a really difficult thing to do?
No, I don't think it is, because for one thing, you have a body of knowledge that you need to share with those pupils, and you wouldn't really go into teaching unless you had a genuine interest in their learning and their well-being. So there's a job to do and there are people to engage with, and that's enough.
For how long?
That was 4 years.
4 years.
And I did love the school, but I didn't really love the Medway towns, and I wanted to move somewhere more rural. So it was really to do with the setting rather than the school.
So you were looking around, presumably, then, at what other jobs might come up, and you did eventually spot one that you fancied.
I did. So I decided to move west, and I moved to a school in Newbury in West Berkshire, and I taught there full time, and over time I became the head of biology, and then I took on a role with leadership of staff, continuing professional development, and I still teach there one day a week. I've taken on lots of other things, and when we moved to the farm over 8 years ago, I became part-time, but I love working at the school, and it's great to keep my sort of hand in with current curriculum teaching. It supports all the other work I do, as well as being enjoyable in its own right.
Somewhere along the line, you hatched an idea about Stoke Hill, but you know, you were in Newbury at the time, so how did that shape out?
We moved to the farm first, actually, and the farm is small, but it's absolutely lovely. It's a beautiful green space, wonderful views. There's species-rich hedgerows and wildflower meadows and a pond and a stream. And it's a wonderful environment for well-being, just for spending time in. So an idea started to crystallise then. But initially, I had the school, the educational focus of the school groups. And for the last just couple of years, I've been more and more focused on provision for adults, particularly for older adults. And that takes a variety of forms: health walks, and then green space at Stoke Hill, courses and workshops.
So lots of potential within your setting, but you were working in Newbury at the time. So what made you think, oh, let's buy a farm in Somerset? Was that a bit of a leap?
It was a bit of a leap, but we weren't living in Newbury. We were living in the countryside anyway. So I never lived in Newbury. And we just wanted to have a space around us to enjoy and to keep some livestock on. And that was the time to do it. It sort of reached a now or never moment.
So initially it was just, let's buy this little farm and, you know, we'll have some chickens or whatever it may be. But you didn't have the idea initially of the Stoke Hill involvement then?
I would say the two sort of went together, actually. There was always an idea that it wouldn't just be our home, although it is a wonderful home that we love, and it's too small. It's been a farm for hundreds of years, and for about 40 years before we came, it was a dairy farm, but it's very small, and it would be difficult to run a commercial farm on it. And I think everybody around us was worried that somebody would move in and develop it and put houses on it. So it was a mixture of all sorts of things. It was, what are we going to do with this beautiful space? And actually, we've reached a sort of mixture of things. There's the educational work, there's the well-being work, and we're also managing the farm for biodiversity and conservation of various species.
Was Somerset a particular destination that you fancied, or did it just happen to be where the farm was for sale at that time?
A bit of each. My parents moved to Devon when Joe and I left school, so it's an area that we know fairly well. It's also quite near an area where we used to go on holiday. Mark, my husband, was just very accommodating of the idea, and we both love it.
Excellent. Okay. So you took the decision, you bought Stoke Hill.
We did.
And was it a farm at that time, or had it ceased to be?
The land was being let for use for some beef cattle, but the couple that had bought it in the late 60s had lived there and died there after a long and happy life there. And so it was running down very much by the time we went there.
I see. And the intention, was it then to cease teaching, or you went part-time in the end, didn't you? Or did you stay working full-time for a while?
I think I lasted about a year. It's quite a commute. It's 80 miles. Mm. Also, it wasn't practical to start having livestock, and you can't have that size of land without managing it in some way. We certainly didn't want anybody just mowing the grass and wasting it. So a small flock of sheep, Shetland sheep, arrived, and that small flock is now 50-something Shetland sheep. And you can't have livestock and be working full-time 80 miles away. No. So
Something had to give
something
eventually.
Had to give.
Yeah, I see. So you carried on teaching for a little while, but then thought, well, I still want to be a teacher, presumably. So you kept a hand in doing that, but it's more a full-time involvement at Stoke Hill now.
Very much. Well, a combination of a small amount of teaching in Newbury, the face roll, which is just over a day a week, that takes me across the southwest, and the rest of the time very much focused on Stoke Hill.
So Stoke Hill, then you've bought this farm and you start having ideas about what you can do with it. Making those into reality, I guess, takes a little bit of time and imagination and quite a lot of effort, I would think.
That's hard to answer, really. I think ideas come to you and you talk to other people and you think about what the outcomes are that you're trying to achieve and which groups you want to work with, and things sort of move incrementally as you become more focused. The target groups that I prefer to work with are people who are experiencing mild to moderate anxiety or depression, very particularly people who are coming to the end of cancer treatment and are a bit in that sort of unknown stage, people who are approaching retirement, really anybody who is going through some sort of transition and might enjoy a blend of learning and of gentle exercise and a bit of practical activity and a bit of connecting with other people. I mean, really, anyone can come to, certainly on the walks, we get all sorts of people coming on the Calm on the Farm health walks. But for the courses and the workshops, there are limited places. They're free because they're funded by Somerset Skills and Learning as part of their community learning partnership. But my first choice of participants are people who are facing some sort of life change.
We'll talk a little bit more in a minute about what exactly Stoke Hill currently offers and who your clients are and who it's of interest to. But I'm just thinking, you've arrived down in this farm in Somerset, and presumably there's quite a bit of transition to do. You've got to build it up to make what you've now got. And did that take a while to achieve?
Yes. But what I try to do is offer something that I can deliver at the time and then try and move forward with that. So setting it up for school groups meant installing a loo and doing some plumbing. So I've learned some new skills as well, and planning activities and making sure that the routes are suitable for those groups. So again, it's step by step.
Yeah, yeah. All right. As I say, we'll come back and talk about the current activities in a minute. Shall we take your next track? Which is, oh, this is a bit more highbrow, isn't it? This is a bit of handle now. This is the Queen of Sheba, isn't it? Why this one?
It is, and you've very kindly accommodated my request of having a piano duet version. I've chosen this one because I bought a horse in 1990. That was a long realised dream. And after a few years where I was keeping him, he went to live with Henry, who is the horse of some very, very dear friends of mine, Sylvia and Norman. And so we spent a lot of time together, and Sylvia is very creative and generally talented, but one of her skills is that she's able to teach the piano, which was a secret yearning of mine. And rather than just teach me scales and things, which I tried to do at home, not very well on my own, Sylvia and I, after we'd dealt with the horses and we'd come in and have a cup of tea, we would sit down at her piano and play duets. And Sylvia, one of the sort of brilliant things, she would pick duets where my part was essentially pom, 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 pom. And Sylvia's had all the sort of frills and flowery bits, so that at the end of it, there was a more or less lovely noise concealing my kind of fumbling playing. And one of the pieces I really enjoyed to play, precisely because there's a very easy bit and a much more skilled bit, is the Queen of Sheba. And when you play it, it's going to be about 10 times faster than we played it, but it's still a great favourite because of that.
Okay, let's have it. It's Handel's Arrival of the Queen of Sheba, played as a piano duet. Here we are. Well, there we are. That is The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba by Handel from Solomon, and written in 1748, played there by Archie Chen and Lance Coburn, although it was written originally for two oboes and strings, and featured, of course, in the London 2012 Olympics opening ceremony, but not played on the piano, I don't think. Chosen by my guest in the studio today, Debbie Hicks of Stoke Hill. Debbie, we've talked about your career as a teacher and an ongoing career, because you're still teaching one day a week. You're still teaching biology, I assume. Yes. But the love of your life had arrived in the form of Stoke Hill Farm, as it was, the realisation of an ambition then, perhaps.
Yes.
And you've got Stoke Hill, and you've been saying that it didn't actually need an awful lot of work doing to it to become what it now is, which is an educational facility. Tell me, your website describes it as being a well-being and educational facility. And educational, I think we're familiar with. What does well-being mean?
Well, I might be going to give you a politician's answer to this, because there's a lot of debate about what well-being means. Is it physical health? Is it mental health? Is it an absence of ill health of some kind? But I think in general, it's now thought to be a general feeling that all is well with the world, or well with one's own world within the parameters of other constraints, but certainly an important part of it is connection to other people. A lot of research has indicated that engaging with green space and engaging with learning are particularly beneficial, and also physical exercise. And I've tried to build that into the design of what I offer for older adults at Stoke Hill as part of Green Space at Stoke Hill, which is the umbrella term for the workshops, the six-week courses, and the Calm on the Farm health walks.
You offer these facilities to several distinct groups of clients. The educational bit is fairly straightforward. How do you engage with schools? Do they come to you, or do you go to them, or what?
Well, as part of my face role, I travel all over the place. When school groups come to me, they're coming to Stoke Hill. Probably quite a difficult distinction to explain, but that they're coming to Stoke Hill if it's a school and I'm inviting them. But with FACE, I engage with schools all the way across the southwest. Only occasionally directly with the schools. For example, I was at Brookside School in Street a couple of weeks ago, and some of your listeners who maybe aren't listening to Abbey 104 all the time might have heard that on Farming Today on Thursday this week. So there I was working with a teacher and a class of pupils, and we co-designed a lesson around food miles and local food and the importance of that for the environment, for farmers, the economy. So there's that sort of thing which is just with an individual school. But more usually it will be with a group of schools, or with, as I said earlier, an agricultural society laying something on for a school. I might come in and make sure that it's linked to the curriculum. They might invite me in to do that. Or it could be with all sorts of organisations. I'm doing something with the library in Wincanton in spring next year. And in the role, FACE educational consultants usually act as the educational and farming link specialists. So they're making sure that the agricultural information is accurate, but that it's relevant to school children.
All right. Tell us again, just before we go on, the FACE, which is Farming and Countryside Education.
Yes.
What do they actually do? You're the local representative, or the Southwest representative.
Yes.
But what's their MO?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to give you more acronyms now. FACE has very recently merged with LEAF, and LEAF is linking environment and farming. And FACE's role is to connect school children with food and farming, to see the relevance of that into their daily life. So I'm carrying out activities that reinforce that message and provide the support to teachers and to farmers in my region. But that's going on across the country. And then there's a national office based in Stoneleigh Park. And Stoneleigh Park is full of other agricultural organisations, so there's close links there as well.
You engage with local schools, and some of them come to you, as you say.
Yeah.
And what do you actually do with them when they get to you? You've got livestock, haven't you, on the
yes.
farm?
Yes. Yes, and sometimes the livestock are explicitly linked to what we're doing, and sometimes they're just there as part of it. Really, I do whatever the school wants. I have a pre-visit from the teachers first, and we walk around, and that, for a start, enables them to write their own risk assessment. I obviously have risk assessments for the farm, but I don't know their group, which is why I like them to come first. And then I tailor the offer which will be very different if it's 5-year-olds to if it's 15-year-olds. So we'll look at the part of the curriculum they want to cover, and then I'll build in a walk around the farm to the a relevant area. So if I give you just one example, it might be that the focus is going to be on maths of some sort, but we'll tie it into the farm. So we might walk around, we might collect, this would be for a younger group, we might collect examples of wildflowers, and then the children might group them and sort them based on, for example, colour, and then use that to construct histograms, and they'll decide the axes of the histograms and how to position the flowers. So they've spent time outside, but they've had a useful learning activity, and they've learned about how you can present data.
Right, so the teacher comes and does a pre-visit, and then the children come along, and you've got a specific link there to a particular part of the curriculum, as you say, and this can be key stage 1 through 4, I think, your website. So that's one element of it, but then there's lots of others, isn't there? So you offer CPD, continuing professional development, for teachers as well, don't you?
Yes, that's part of through my FACE role, and again, sometimes that's on the farm, so a group of teachers might come and learn about practical activities that they could do back at school, or they might learn more theoretically about food and farming. But quite often that would be off the farm. So, for example, I was doing a conference at Sparsholt College recently for teachers and farmers, running workshops on various activities. I had burly farmers making corn dollies and groups of teachers and farmers simulating the parts of a combine harvester with a human model, all activities that they can then take back and do with groups that, in the case of farmers, are coming to their farm, or with teachers, something they can do back at school. Or I did something at the Association for Science Education conference at Reading University January 2017. And on that, we were looking at how you can use the farm as a context for scientific investigations. And again, the teachers were carrying out practical activities in a room in the university, but they're ones that they could do outside, or they could do in their school grounds or in their classrooms.
I see. And another group that you engage with are people who have suffered with long-term health conditions, and they come to you, well, for what? This is for recuperation in some way, part of their mental health recuperation?
Not necessarily mental health, although I do offer courses to people with mild to moderate anxiety or depression. So the people that come to me for green space workshops or courses might just be people who've become aware that this is something that's available and that they'd like to do it, and that's absolutely fine. Or what sometimes happens is they are recommended to me from health coaches from GP surgeries or village agents or community connectors. And I'm just starting to get interest from GPs themselves as they become more involved in the world of what's called social prescribing, i.e. looking for non-medical solutions to non-medical problems. I've spoken at cancer patients' forums and to groups at Yeovil Hospital. And really, I'd like to make more people who are coming to the end of cancer treatment aware that this is available, because all sorts of things are offered. For example, breast cancer patients are offered Look Good, Feel Better workshops to do with cosmetics. And those are wonderful, positive, supportive offers. But some people would like either something different or something additional. And for them, being out in a field and doing some sort of practical activity, getting lots of fresh air, seeing the green space, might be an additional or a different thing that they might like to do.
And these are referred to you either by GPs or support groups, are they?
Some are, and then some people just become aware. Sometimes I go and speak at or have a stall at wellbeing fairs that are popping up all over the place around village halls and GP surgeries now. So some people just come across me and then I tell them about the places.
It sounds wonderful. You've got 20 acres, I think, haven't you? Though?
We have, which is tiny as a farm. And as I say to people who come on the Calm on the Farm health walks, they often come from existing Walking for Health groups. So I've had people from Langport and I've had people from Wincanton. So they're coming just for a different walk. But we could walk around our farm in about 35 to 40 minutes. But in fact, we spend about an hour and a half because we look at all sorts of things. We look at the dormouse tubes. We've got a project with Somerset Wildlife Trust who are monitoring dormice on the farm. We look at the hedgerows, we look at the wildflowers, we look at the sheep. We've got some semi-feral New Forest rescue ponies people always like to have a look at them. I always say don't stroke them, they're a bit wild, and people always go straight up to them and stroke them, and no one's ever been bitten yet. The ponies are in a separate field to the walkers. And we've got chickens, we've got guinea fowl. So there's a lot to see. We've got the stream, we've just had some woody dams created in there to try and reduce the impact on flooding in people lower down the catchments. And one of the workshops that I ran earlier this year, it was about the environment, and some of those woody dams were being constructed by a tree surgeon where people were there. So they were able to look at that. And then we went back up to the yard and we looked at a model of the Somerset Hills and Levels, an interactive model. It's really for children. Somerset Wildlife Trust had brought it along, and the adults were dived in and were playing with the gates and the cloud models. So really the workshops are all about learning, but also about getting out in that green space and having time to chat.
The well-being and enjoying your surroundings. Let's take your penultimate track and then we'll come back and finish off. This is called The Killing Moon.
It is. It's The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen. And it's definitely not the words in this. I couldn't even tell you what most of the words are. I like it because I like the light and the shade of the music. And also because I associate this with my wonderful husband, Mark. Maybe that's to do with the light and shade as well. Also, it has some resonances back to the 80s when I just vaguely remember it as a jolly nice song. But I've chosen it today because it reminds me of Mark.
The Killing Moon, then, by Echo and the Bunnymen. Echo and the Bunnymen and The Killing Moon from 1984, chosen by Debbie Hicks. Debbie, you've obviously got quite a successful little venture there going in Stoke Hill. What's the ambitions for the future?
I'd definitely like to scale up Stoke Hill and also sort of widen the offer to different groups of people. The farm itself needs to be developed a bit. We're still moving towards restoring these lowland meadows. And also, I'd like to be able to spend some time just relaxing a bit more with Mark, because he also has a very busy job as a deputy head teacher. And of course, there's the dogs, spending time with the dogs. So I think that's probably quite enough with everything else that's going on.
So more of the same then. You'd like to expand a little bit, but
yes.
You're not looking to buy another one and become a multinational.
I'm definitely not looking to buy another one, although I think it is something that could be replicated elsewhere. So I wouldn't rule out working with other people to help them develop a similar facility. I think the blend of learning and exercise and social connection is one that could do with some expansion, particularly for older people.
And you're happily teaching one day a week still, and you want to carry on doing that?
I certainly do for the foreseeable future. Yeah. It may become untenable as Stoke Hill builds up.
And your involvement with FACE, the Farming and Countryside Education, you enjoy that and that will continue
very much
as well.
It's an absolute privilege to have had that job. It's something that I came across years ago and I thought, oh my goodness, that is the perfect job. And it came up and I was lucky enough to get it. So I'm very grateful for that job.
And what about spare time? I mean, you've got a lovely setting there and you could do no worse than simply enjoy what you have and wander around your farm. But do you do anything interesting in your spare time?
I think everything I've told you is includes spare time as well.
OK, well, we're coming towards the end of the interview and you've actually chosen quite a long piece to end with, really. This is Thomas Tallis, isn't it? And
yes.
The Speminalium, which is a 40-part motet. Tell us about this one.
Well, this is a genuinely beautiful piece of music. The others I've just chosen, as you know, because they resonate with some part of my life. But this I first heard over 25 years ago at the home of a really great friend of mine, Sue. She was out of the room at the time getting, well, I'm going to say it was a cup of coffee, but I suspect it might have been something stronger. This came on and I found it absolutely mesmerising. I'd sung in a choir at school, but I hadn't sung this, so I knew choral music a bit, but this was so wonderful. I played it to my mother, actually, a bit later, and she said it sounded like a tape being played backwards. So, obviously...
she wasn't overly impressed, then.
Obviously, she doesn't appeal to everybody. But I think it was wonderful. And Sue has been a fantastic friend to me, so I would like to dedicate this last one to her.
OK. This is the Tallis Scholars under Peter Phillips, I think, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And, as I say, it's a 40-part Renaissance motet composed in 1570 for 8 choirs of 5 voices, hence the 40 parts. And it's a wonderful piece of music, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Debbie,
wonderful.
I want to thank you for coming in, and we wish you well with Stoke Hill and your various other activities, and we look forward to seeing them go from strength to strength.
Thank you very much. It's been such a privilege to come here and I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.